You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Last month, pharmaceutical giant Merck pulled its biggest-selling drug, the pain reliever Vioxx, pulled it right off the market. A clinical trial of the drug was halted when researchers discovered it increased risk, small but significant, of heart attack and stroke for patients taking the drug. The study confirms earlier studies showing a link between Vioxx and heart problems, and that raises the question about how a drug, which had earlier shown to cause health risks in these earlier studies, could still be taken by millions of people. And it raises questions about the safety of this whole class of drugs known as COX-2 inhibitors. Whose job is it to make sure that these drugs are safe? Isn't the FDA supposed to oversee the safety of drugs? Critics say the system needs fixing and that the FDA needs to keep closer tabs on drugs when they're still in the development pipeline, as they say, as well as once they're on the market, making sure that tests are big enough and last long enough to detect the problems such as those found with Vioxx. So for the rest of the hour, we're going to talk about the rise and fall of Vioxx. Maybe there's a lesson here to be learned from its demise. We'll also talk about the power of the drug company's marketing machines. Are you being seduced into taking the newest, most expensive medicine? Hey, when there's an older, cheaper drug that may be safer and more effective, and you could probably, maybe in some cases, buy it right over the counter. If you'd like to join our discussion, our number is 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. And as always, you can surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com. Let me introduce my guests. Alastair Wood is a professor of medicine and of pharmacology and associate dean at Vanderbilt University Medical School in Nashville. He's here in New York in our studios. Welcome, Dr. Wood.
Thank you.
Jerry Avorn is the author of Powerful Medicines, the Benefits, Risks, and Costs of Prescription Drugs, published this year by Knopf. Dr. Avorn is Associate Professor of Medicine at Harvard Medical School and Chief of the Division of Pharmacoepidemiology at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. He joins us today from member station WBUR in Boston. Welcome to the program, Dr. Avorn.
Thank you, Ira.
Doctor, well, let's talk about Vioxx. This has had a really interesting history of testing for this drug. There was for early indications that there were problems, right, before we got to this point.
Right. There were there were indications earlier from another study that was done called the Vigor study that this drug caused an increased rate of heart attacks and an increased rate of other cardiovascular problems. That increase, however, was in comparison to another drug, a standard non-steroidal drug called naproxen. What Merck and others did after that study came out was they interpreted that the results of that study as showing not that Vioxx was bad, but that rather naproxen was good, and that naproxen was reducing the rate of heart attacks and cardiovascular disease in contrast to Vioxx that was increasing it. Now, that might have been reasonable. The only thing that ought to have made us wonder a bit about that was that if it was doing that, it was doing it much more effectively than, say, a drug like aspirin, which had previously been shown to do this.
Mm-hmm. And then we had the 2000 New England Journal of Medicine study, right?
That's the study we're talking about.
Yeah. The problems date back for a while. Didn't the FDA, Dr. Wood, make Merck change the label like to reflect these heart risks? I mean, are label changes effective?
Well, there's two questions there. I think both of these are excellent questions. They did make them change the label, which now reflected the fact that perhaps there were risks of cardiovascular disease from this drug. However, it's reasonable to ponder this question. What was that supposed to do? You know, it's kind of like when you're driving down these roads and there's a sign at the side of the road that says, beware of rocks. Mm-hmm. What do you do with that information? And how are doctors supposed to implement that once they get that information? Clearly, given that 2 million people were still taking this drug when it was taken off the market, it didn't restrict doctors' prescribing of the drug. So I'm not sure what the FDA expected to achieve when they made that label change, but I suspect that whatever it was, it didn't get achieved.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Avorn, you yourself had raised concerns about Vioxx.
That's right. There was a study that was done led by Dr. Dan Solomon in my division at the Brigham in which we tried to take on this question in a couple of ways. And early on, we published a study looking at whether naproxen really is as protective as Merck had claimed, and that that was the reason, as Dr. Wood said, for the difference in vigor. And we found that, no, there might have been a small protective effect of naproxen, but it was an implausible argument that actually naproxen was the result of or was the cause of that difference seen with vigor. Mm-hmm. Secondly, we went ahead and did a study under Dr. Solomon's direction that was published a year ago, in which we actually looked at the rate of heart attack in people taking Vioxx or rofecoxib and other drugs, including Celebrex. And we found a 70% increase in the risk of heart attack in people taking Vioxx compared to people taking Celebrex. Hmm. And every step of the way, Merck was questioning those findings and doubting whether or not this was a true observation, even though, in fact, they had funded our study.
Well, why did it take until now for us to hear about all these things? Dr. Wood?
Well, I think that's a good question. I think what's really scary here is this was a drug that was being taken by 2 million people. Probably as many as 10 million or more people have taken this drug worldwide. And we knew, as you said earlier, that this drug was at least associated with these problems 4.5 years ago. Yet it's taken us 4.5 years to do a study that only required 2,600 people to show this effect. And that study was not even designed to determine the safety of the drug. It was designed to actually extend the market for this drug by hopefully demonstrating that it would prevent colon cancer.
Mm-hmm. And so where do our regulators, we have the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, where are they sitting while all this is happening?
Well, I think there's two questions there. In your introduction, you raised the question about what studies we should do before a drug was marketed. Mm-hmm. And actually, I don't think that would have taken care of this. And I don't think these studies here actually should have been done before the drug was marketed. The drug probably was studied appropriately at that stage. However, once the suspicion was raised, we ought to have moved very quickly and demanded a study that would demonstrate once and for all that this drug was safe and that this drug was not increasing the risk of cardiac disease in patients who were at risk.
When you say we should have demanded, who's the we?
Who's we? That's a good question. I guess Jerry certainly demanded it, and many others did as well. The FDA says now that they're not in a position to demand studies. I think that's a little disingenuous, frankly. The company certainly ought to have proceeded with alacrity to do these studies. I think they did not proceed as fast as they should. But clearly, we need a better system to take care of this. We ought not to be sitting here 4.5 years after the first study came out and speculating about what should or shouldn't have been done. We ought to know for certain what was done, who was responsible for this, and we ought to be learning from this error so that in the future we can move forward and deal with these issues more carefully.
Jerry,
I think listeners ought to understand something that is not widely perceived, and that is that an awful lot of the drug research that gets done is marketing-driven rather than science-driven. And that is, a company will do a study in order to get their drug approved, and once that is done, and it may be for as short a period as 2 or 3 or 4 months, even for a drug taken over a lifetime, and it may involve a very highly selected group of patients so as to avoid sick people in the study, and once you can show that your drug is better than placebo, which is FDA's favorite comparison drug, you are free, if you're a drug company, to market your product. And if there are other important scientific questions that come up, the companies tend to not pursue them unless there appears to be a marketing advantage, as Alistair said, to get another reason for using their drug. But when it was obvious that there were some very important clinical and safety and scientific questions about these drugs as early as the year 2000-2001, the FDA was really asleep at the switch and has been since then in not saying, look, there's a signal here. We don't know if it's going to pan out, but we demand that there be a study done. And the FDA failed to do that.
What is the politics of this? Why?
Well, FDA, especially in the current administration, has been awfully afraid of alienating industry. And there seems to be a great fear that they will antagonize drug companies, which are among the most generous contributors to campaign contributions and to lobbying efforts. And they've got a lot of clout in Washington. And I think the result is that FDA has become more timid than a public health authority ought to be.
Dr. Wood, tell us, you said that things should be changed. Give me a recipe, a formula, that how you would change the drug testing.
Well, I think it's not so much a change in drug testing. Let me give you an analogy. When an aircraft crashes, we have a public inquiry into that. We learn exactly what went wrong. When TWA Flight 800 went down into Long Island Sound, we now know, even those of us who are not involved in aircraft safety, know that it was the center tank and the wiring that caused that, that crash. Now, the reason I bring that up is we know that because an agency independent of that of those that approved the drug in this case or that were marketing the drug looked into the problems that caused it. And we ought to have the same thing here. This is the use of drugs and the public health risks associated with the use of drugs is at least as serious as most of the other issues that we investigate publicly in this country.
So we should have an independent. You're talking about the National Transportation Safety Board that always comes in during a flight crash.
Exactly.
You're saying we need something, a National Drug Safety Board or something like that.
I think we certainly should have something like that that it would inform us. It's disturbing to me that Jerry Avorn and I, who spend most of our life thinking about these issues, don't and won't know exactly what happened here and won't know what the potential improvements we could make to the system are, because that will be buried in the depths of the files of the FDA and the company.
1-800-989-8255. Let's get a few calls in here. Gary in Wichita. Hi, Gary.
Hi, how you doing? Oh, I love the show.
Thanks.
And I especially love the fact that you're doing this topic. I worked for an orthopedist, and one of the things I did was screening patients, especially ones that were coming back, and one of the first questions is, how's the medication doing? Do you need something else? And I think the advertising on TV just has to be banned again. You know, it wasn't until recently that they allowed it, and they should ban it again. There's no real reason for it except for these companies to increase their brand identification. They rarely do anything in the way of educating, and besides which, it's a doctor's choice what that patient's going to go on.
And but doesn't the doctor get his info from those salespeople who come in and disrupt your waiting room and say, "I'm going to see the doctor first"?
Absolutely. And he took a member of his staff and himself once to a Vioxx. It was actually a Vioxx dinner where they had dinner, and then all these other doctors and staff members would go through an educational thing on Vioxx and all the things about Vioxx. Mm. And you know, that's where the money should go, if anywhere. But, you know, they now spend more on advertising than they do on research.
Jerry Avorn, you've done your own research on the marketing techniques.
That's right. And the caller is absolutely right. The numbers, which I got to look at from the Health and Human Services Department, which is a fairly reasonable group of people to collect data on this and certainly not antagonistic to companies. When I was putting together the section of powerful medicines, I went and looked it up. And sure enough, there's about 30% of revenues of the drug companies go to promotion, marketing, and administration. And another 20% goes for profit for the shareholders, and only about 13% goes for research.
So if
the argument gets made, this is the way we discover the new drugs of tomorrow, I can think of an awfully more efficient way of getting the dollars into the hands of the scientists that are actually doing the discovery.
But whenever you talk to an individual from the drug industry, they'll say, well, sure, drug prices are high, but we have to do research. Well, obviously the money's going elsewhere. And did you know that in Canada they don't allow advertising? It's a wonder that things are so much cheaper in Canada. But the last,
especially because they get all of our cable stations and stuff over the airways that leaks in for the U.S. that seems to get to them anyway.
All right, thanks.
But the last point I wanted to make also was, I also heard this, that there are more drug company lobbyists in D.C. than there are members of Congress.
That is a true fact, yes.
All right, Keith, thanks for calling. Our number 1-800-989-8255. We're talking about drug safety this hour on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News, with Alistair Wood and Jerry Avorn. We've already put our safety into the hands of drug companies because they do the original testing. Do we trust the results? If you give the people who are responsible for your safety, for creating the drugs, also the power to test the drugs, isn't there sort of a conflict of interest there? And we do this in all the industries, not just the drug industry. Do this in car industry and other places.
I'm sorry, Alistair, go ahead.
Well, I think in contrast to the car industry, we at least in medicine have a means of publishing results,
right.
And that's that results ought to be published in peer-reviewed journals, and they're then open to assessment by other scientists and so on. I think it's important to emphasize that drugs have almost inevitable side effects. That's not necessarily a bad thing. We expect that we're more tolerant of side effects when the benefit that the drug achieves is enormous. So we tolerate different levels of side effects from a drug, for instance, that might cure cancer than say we would for a drug that was marketed to cure nasal allergies or something. So it's not an absolute standard. There's a need to vary what we want in terms of safety depending on the strength of the indication.
Jerry, you want to jump in there?
Yeah, I agree with Alistair on probably about 99% of everything he says, but I think the one thing that he just said I'm not sure I totally agree with, which is the data are there, and if the studies are well done, anybody can look at them and see. But as he mentioned a couple of minutes ago, and as we saw with the antidepressant suicide story just a few weeks ago, it turns out, we now learn, that there are data that are in the hands of the companies from clinical trials, which they don't need to reveal to the public or even to us physicians, that could be very important. And in the case of the antidepressants, there was indeed a smoking gun, which is a terrible metaphor, of people trying to kill themselves with SSRI antidepressants in the younger age group that simply did not come to light. So even if the studies were well done, it's terribly scary that there can be data that are in the hands of the companies, which they then depict as proprietary information that they don't have to reveal to anybody.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's absolutely right, Jerry. And in fact, today, Pfizer have made an announcement sort of buried at the end of their press release about Bextra, another drug in this class, another COX-2 inhibitor, in which it turns out that they have had data, which they've not released yet, that this drug, too, increases the risk of heart disease in patients who are getting cardiac surgery. Previously, about a year ago, there was another small study that showed that, and now that another study has been done which confirms that. So this other drug in the same class appears to do the same thing, albeit in a group at high risk undergoing cardiac surgery.
Yeah, that was just news that was released today. The Bextra.
Yet it was not. It was not data that was collected today.
That's my point. Well, that's my point. And not only that, but the other data was out there already. And what's important was that the label for Bextra has not been altered based on that other data.
Do you think we're going to see a drip now? Other data showing up on other me too drugs, or
I think you mean on the other COX-2 inhibitors.
Yeah.
Well, I think what's a reasonable question to ask is what should patients do right now who are on COX-2 inhibitors, and should they continue on COX-2 inhibitors? I think if we were asking that question even a week ago, one might have been reasonably comfortable recommending that patients who were on Vioxx switch to another COX-2 inhibitor if their indication was strong enough, and I'll come back to that in a second. I think now that we know that another COX-2 inhibitor seems to be associated with an increase in cardiac disease and in thromboembolic disease, we really need to say that the people who are on these drugs need to have an awfully strong indication to be taking them. And as Jerry knows as well, the indications that these drugs actually prevent GI problems is not that strong anyway. So I think the only patients who should be taking these drugs right now are patients who have a history of a GI problem on a previous non-steroidal or a very strong history of a GI ulcer in the past. And patients either at risk of cardiovascular disease or patients particularly with a history of cardiovascular disease ought not to be taking these drugs.
All right, we're going to take a short break, come back and talk lots more with Alistair Wood and Jerry Avorn and your questions. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Ira Flatto, and this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I am Ira Flatto. Next week, Talk of the Nation starts a series of programs on key issues this election year with representatives of President Bush and Senator Kerry here to answer your questions. And first up on Tuesday is health care, followed on Thursday by the economy. And we want to make sure we hear from as many of you as we can. So if you have a direct stake in these issues, for example, if you're a doctor, a nurse, a patient, a business person, a worker, or someone who's unemployed, email your suggestions to totn@npr.org and make sure you put healthcare or economy in the subject line. We'll look at your letters and call some of you back next week. We're talking this hour about Vioxx and drug testing with my guest, Dr. Jerry Avorn, author of Powerful Medicines, the Benefits, Risks, and Costs of Prescription Drugs, out this year from Knopf. He's also Associate Professor of Medicine at Harvard Medical School. Dr. Alistair Wood, Professor of Medicine and of Pharmacology, and Associate Dean at Vanderbilt University Medical School in Nashville. Our number 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to the phones for a few phone calls. Keith in Sacramento. Hi, Keith.
Hello. How do you do?
Hi.
I've been interested in listening to your phone call, particularly about Vioxx, because on the 7th of August, I had a stroke. And I've been on Vioxx for the last 4.5 years. I honestly, when I had the stroke, I had no thought that Vioxx had anything to do with it and continued taking it. But having been hospitalized and had a CAT scan, they found that I'd actually had two strokes. And my doctor said to me, you know, Keith, he said, we can't find a reason why you had a stroke. You're not a candidate. You know, you're like maybe 20 pounds overweight. Your blood pressure's just a shade high. Your cholesterol's borderline. And, you know, you're not what we would put on as a candidate. But then I get a stroke. And after that, I find that I've had two strokes. It's extremely frustrating when you see the Vioxx advert of this little guy walking along the North Carolina beach looking for clams or seashells and feeling how wonderful he is. And I find that sort of advertising rather offensive because you've probably gathered from my accent that I'm European.
Mm-hmm.
In Britain, pharmaceutical adverts are just not allowed on television, let alone in the paper. And the decision to give a patient medication is done by the doctor. And I find medical advertising like that is extremely offensive.
Mm-hmm.
Then your colleague before mentioned, you know, it was all right to get some side effects. And the question that crossed my mind at the time is you have a cancer drug which helps cure cancer, but then it gives you a heart attack and you die of the heart attack. Well, it doesn't make a lot of difference to me then, you know, which drug you're taking if the side effects are going to be as bad as the issue that you're suffering.
Good point.
I just really, you know, feel that the problem lies when you follow the money. And I wonder just how much money the pharmaceutical companies actually have to pay backhander lobby to get what they want on the market.
All right, let me ask that point that question to Jerry. Jerry Avorn?
Well, actually, back in the 90s, there was a specific decision made that the drug companies would begin paying the FDA to review their drugs. This was, I guess, to save the federal government some money. It happened as part of the 1995 contract with America or on America. And the problem with that is that they have tended to have more influence over FDA ever since that time, especially if you also add in the lobbying and the campaign contributions that we talked about earlier. And so it's not as if you could, in a Watergate way, sort of follow the checks and see who cashed it, as much as a general sensibility that has developed in Washington that let's not try to offend the industry because they are in some ways influencing our fates.
Okay, Dr. Wood?
I also should respond to that. I think it's important for us to recognize that that drugs do have huge benefits. And so, you know, part of our job is to balance the risk-benefit ratio for a drug when we prescribe a drug to any of our patients. It's awfully easy when something like this happens, and I'm not here to defend this, but it's awfully easy when something like this happens to lose sight of the fact that we've saved a huge number of lives from people with heart disease by lowering their cholesterol, by lowering their blood pressure, and by giving them appropriate heart care and so on. So we don't want to throw out the baby with the bathwater. We want just to ensure that drugs are being used appropriately. Now, here, the indication was relatively trivial, and there were other effective medicines that appear not to have these side effects. So that's important to recognize when you're making a prescribing decision.
Mm-hmm.
And the other point that is really not as widely known as it ought to be is that these drugs, the Celebrex, Vioxx, the whole COX-2 class, were never, ever shown to be better pain relievers, as in stronger pain relievers, than Motrin, ibuprofen, aspirin, and drugs that we've had around for years. And yet the commercials, as the caller was describing, tend to give that impression, and people say, I've never felt this good. They don't work any better, and that makes it particularly more ironic that we are incurring greater risk in exchange, really, for no benefit in terms of pain relief and maybe a modest relief of the risk of stomach problems, but that seems to go away if you're also taking aspirin to prevent heart disease, as you should be in many cases.
Now, one of the points about direct-to-consumer advertising, however, is that that's viewed as a First Amendment right. The rights of the drug companies for commercial free speech is enshrined in our Constitution, and one can argue the toss about that. But we probably move into impairing these communication channels at our peril.
Alistair, you would agree that it was we had a healthcare system that worked pretty much as well as it ever did before we had direct-to-consumer advertising. And I think you would also agree that there's an awful lot of countries in the world, in fact, every other country besides New Zealand, I believe, that does not managed to have direct-to-consumer advertising, although I don't think of them as necessarily being police states.
I agree with that, but I'm just explaining why the argument that's been put forward by the other side.
Well, the argument, we had the head of pharma on, was it last week, week before? I can't remember. But he was on, and we asked him about the direct-to-consumer advertising, and his response was, the response we've gotten people to ask to come to the doctors who would never come into the office, and then we could detect other things that we might pick up along in a physical exam. I can't argue with that. I did argue. I said, well, why don't you just ask people to come get a checkup instead? And that's not their job. And he readily admitted this is a business. And he had no bones about it. He said this is a business, and this is how we operate, and we have to maximize profits.
Well, I can't argue with that, because if we're now spending as a nation $3.8 billion just on direct-to-consumer ads alone, I can think of a lot of better ways of spending $3.8 billion a year on communication to the public about their health care that would be more user-friendly and more relevant to the public's health and to individual patients than what we now have advertising this purple pill or that allergy medicine, which is not exactly a major public health breakthrough.
But they're not in the business to do that. Public
they're
health,
not.
Yeah.
And right. And the second piece of the objection is, we can't afford to do that. Who's going to pay for it? And the answer is we're already paying for it. We're paying for it in the cost of the Vioxes and of the Nexiums of the world. Those dollars are being paid for somehow by the American people in terms of their drug bills. And so we just need to figure out a way that we perhaps aren't spending our healthcare dollars in that wasteful way, but perhaps are spending it in a more public health oriented way, as is the case in some other countries.
Mm-hmm. Go to Richard in Boise. Hi, Richard.
Hi, good afternoon.
Hi there.
I wanted to make a quick comment. I'm a physician. I wanted to remind all your listeners that don't just stop taking your drugs now. Please call up your physician and go in, see him, and find out what's going on and what his stance is on things. Generally speaking, when these kinds of announcements come out, I wind up getting a bunch of people coming in a month later saying that they had stopped their medications, and then we're kind of behind the eight ball a little bit.
Mm-hmm. But they did take the Vioxx out of your office, didn't they? Tell you to turn it in.
Oh, I'm talking about the Bextra and the Celebrex information that came out. Mm-hmm. And yeah, we removed the Vioxx from the office, and within 2 hours of that announcement, I didn't prescribe Vioxx very much anymore because I had problems with elevated blood pressure and swelling, which is probably one of the contributing factors to the heart disease that it seems to be promoting. Mm-hmm. And so I shied away from that for a couple of years. I just had too many side effects with it.
Mm-hmm. Did you worry? Did people already come up to you with replacements for it?
You mean patients?
No,
or
the companies.
Pharmaceutical companies. Oh, of course. I in my mail, then 2 days later, I had ads from the manufacturer of Aleve, Naproxen. I had Pfizer give me a phone call and send out mailings. You see on television that Naproxen is doing more direct-to-consumer advertising, saying that they've been around for years and have shown to be safe.
We're talking about drugs this hour on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. As a physician, what do you feel about the Ask Your Doctor campaign?
Well, I think it's very self-serving for the pharmaceutical companies. I think it's window dressing. I think they want to get their information out there, and I think they're using that kind of as justification. Now, it does help because, very frequently patients are not going to come in and ask about erectile dysfunction, for example, because they're too embarrassed to. But they do feel comfortable coming in and saying, hey, I saw that ad for Levitra, or I saw that ad for Vioxx or Viagra. Mm-hmm. And, that does open up the conversation and does bring up subjects that might be a little bit too touchy to talk about otherwise.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for calling.
I just quick mention about the placebo, because one of your the speakers mentioned placebos were the FDA's favorite drug, and actually for pain, they like to compare it to naproxen and to hydrocodone, so I don't think your listeners get too much of a misconception about that.
All right, thank you. 1-800-989-8255. Jerry, any comment?
Well, about the direct-to-consumer advertising?
Yeah.
It's a matter of the assumption that if we just let the marketplaces take care of everything, then we will have the information flowing. And I just don't think that's the best way to get information to flow.
My question is, do doctors have time to study the literature, or do they really, because they have so many patients, and now when you get to see them every 15 minutes, when do you have time to breathe if you want to stay being a doctor? Or do they really rely on, these the salespeople who come in from the drug companies?
They certainly are. Sorry, go ahead. Go ahead, Jerry.
A good doctor really will do his or her best to try to keep up with the literature, but it's a daunting task, and it's so much easier to just wait for these friendly, well-dressed people to come and sit and wait for you for an hour or two and then bring you something nice to eat and some trinkets. And it's so tempting to let them tell you about science. We've tried to kind of take the drug company's own medicine, if you will, and use it in the name of better prescribing by sending out our own friendly, well-dressed people to demarket drugs in doctors' offices and to say, you really don't need to prescribe as much of this, and why don't you try this old drug? It's off-patent, it's cheap, and it works real good. Mm-hmm. And we've been able to show in a couple of projects that that actually does improve prescribing, and you can do that in a pro bono way rather than just to move product.
Is this by like an email message or a web?
No, these are humans going out just like sales reps. We think of them as unsales reps, and we're doing that in our own hospital as well and in a number of other settings, and it can improve prescribing because the only agenda is to get the science right and not to sell product, and doctors appreciate that.
Dr. Wood?
The problem, Jerry, is though that we have a dearth of data. Ira just asked, don't doctors read the literature? Well, they do, of course. The problem is that there were not data in the literature that spoke to these issues. And that's the fundamental problem here, that we're in a situation where a drug is being taken by 10 million people and we don't have studies that demonstrate that the effects that were suggested from an earlier study are either right or wrong. And that's devastating, I think, and that's a devastating indictment of our system.
Mm-hmm. You're absolutely right. We have problems in generating the data, and then when the data are there, we have problems in getting the data out there.
Right. Do you think that your oversight committee would change that?
Well, I think it might. It certainly would allow us to learn what went on here, to make some changes in the system and hopefully tinker with it going forward so that it improves. I can't imagine how openness could hurt us. Every other endeavor that we engage in, that's the American way, and it's hard to imagine how it could hurt here.
What are the odds of getting something like this?
I think they're slim to none. Jerry, what do you think?
It'll ask us again on November 3rd. I think it has to do with the extent to which there's a sense that we need to let industries determine policy in a variety of areas versus the public good. But, Alistair, I love the idea about a board of the kind that you've described, but it would be very important that it have clout of a regulatory kind as well, so that it could go to a Merck or a Pfizer or a Lilly and say, thou shalt do this study because it is important for the public health. And we had the appeals get made. There was a wonderful paper by Dr. Topol in JAMA in 2001 in which he said, we need these studies. Mm-hmm. A year ago in Powerful Medicines, I wrote, we need to understand what it is about Merck and Vioxx and heart attacks that we should know more about. But we lacked the clout. We need to have a body with perhaps FDA's authority to do this.
We'll see how this works out. I'd like to thank both of you for joining us. Jerry Avorn, author of Powerful Medicines, The Benefits, Risks, and Costs of Prescription Drugs. Dry mouth myself today. Alfie Knopf, Dr. Alistair Wood, Professor of Medicine and of Pharmacology, Associate Dean at Vanderbilt University's Medical School in Nashville. Thank you both for joining us this hour.
Thank you.
Our program is produced by Ed Heist, Corey Binns, and Senior Producer Karen Vergoth. Charles Berquist is our web producer. And our director, if you'd like to write us, please send your letters to Science Friday, 55 West 45th Street, 4th floor, New York, New York, 10036. Also, go to our website at sciencefriday.com. We have a free curricula. Science Friday's Kids Connection is there that you can take to your schools. Also, if you'd like to listen on Real Audio to back editions or download on your iPod on audible.com, you can feel free to do that. I'm Ira Flato in New York.